So. Okay. I am ready for your questions. I am ready for your questions. This is my Ishnisha.
Could you meditate as well, maybe?
No, I'm too tired. I'll just be delightful.
I wish I had a camera. Put that on the next newsletter cover.
Guess who brought these?
Mom.
How did you guess that? God, you are so psychic.
I know, it was a big guess.
You know what? There's two. So when I came in the other night, they were sitting like this. So then Dawn immediately says, oh, they'd be great for work.
Right. Yes, it would be too.
And I'm going, awesome. Ushnisha, Ushnisha. So Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhassa. Sadhya. Question and answer night. Yes, sir.
Can you talk about like and dislike? And also, in the context of like and dislike, when, for example, if someone is doing something, you know, you're interacting with somebody and they're making you angry, and you need to continue to interact with them until they stop being making you angry, because making you angry is a lesson that you need to learn.
Yeah.
That kind of a context of like and dislike, yeah. Particularly.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because we tend to be so unconscious in our likes and dislikes. We don't realize half the time when we're caught in one. Isn't that true? So that's why the Buddha's suggestion was not in times of emergency, but occasionally throughout the day, from time to time. When you're just doing not much interesting at all, waiting for the gas tank to be filled or, you know, whatever, just look at something you dislike and find something you like in it. And when you, or look at something you like and find something you dislike in it. Why is that? So you actually become more conscious of your dislike and your like. What will that do for you? That will give you a richer ability to use your mind states rather than being falling into habitual mind states. Does that make sense? What happens if you can actually use your mind states? You feel yourself disliking the way somebody is telling you your job when you're the one who should be telling them your job, right? And someone is telling you that, and you can think, okay, this person, is there something I like about them? And you think, damn, they got beautiful eyes. You switch your focus to their eyes. You're still sitting, standing there. You're still listening to them. You start looking at their eyes. Next thing you know, you're in love. Because people's eyes are so gorgeous. And it's warmth rather than this tightness. So they get less arrogant because your arrogance is less coming out. This tightness disappears, and you're sitting there, and you're thinking, God, nice eyes. And you start softening, and they start softening. Oh, this person actually likes me. They're listening to me. Oh, I must be right here. So then they feel better. And even if they don't, you're not caught in the mind state. And I still think it is probably the most important bit of information the Buddha gave for people who live in the world, how to do your practice. From time to time, when you see something you dislike, find something you like in it. From time to time, when you see something you like, find something you dislike in it. You know, if you look at our society, you look at all the commercials, you look at all of the things that people are expected to buy, all the stuff that comes in your mailbox, all the ways your friends are dressed, all the way, you know, understand? How much of it is like, get away from dislike, get away from dislike, get away from dislike, isn't it? And this continuous breeding of desire for a satisfaction that's essentially unattainable. And how many people are caught in trying to attain something that they can't attain, so they're always just slightly on edge or shocking. Is that true? Do you think that's true, or am I out of line here? Yeah? So if you can actually look at that like and dislike, which becomes this sense of dissatisfaction in yourself, because when you like something, you want it to stay. When you dislike something, you want it to go. And if you can change like to not so hot, you don't feel victimized when it starts to change, right? Because how many of you feel victimized when you think you're going to get something and then you don't? Mm-hmm. Well, there you go. There's a show of hands for you. Mm-hmm. And is it fun? Has it ever been fun? Mm-hmm. Any of you over the age of 15 think it's still fun? I don't think it's fun. Huh? But we fall for it over and over again, don't we? You buy something new, you take it home, there's a little glitch in it. Oh. Like, how much time has elapsed? Or it's like a personal insight, or what did you do? You know, somebody else opened the bag. What did you do to it? You know? It's like perfume, isn't it? Perfume. Instead of, oh, look at this like and dislike. Wonder what choices I have. Can you see how much, I mean, we were talking about Adrea downstairs, can you see how much she's caught up in her mental idea of what she wants and what she doesn't want? Mm-hmm. You see how that has been that slippery road that's taken her right to the point she's in now? I don't know if you see that, but like, you know, just to start being able to turn the mind, to realize if I like something, the reasons for my liking it are essentially in the past. And I don't know in the present what will come from this thing. Is that true? Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether this might be the moment where I have a greater depth of understanding, a greater joy. Isn't that true? But as long as we like or dislike something and then we're immediately shopping in the past, we're already working with what we already know. And if that was going to satisfy us, we wouldn't be shopping. Right? So anytime you compare anything to the past, you're going to get caught in like and dislike. Notice I said compare. It was better then, it was worse then, you know, blah, blah, blah. Because the person who's remembering is in the present. You know that Zen saying, you can't enter the same river twice. You can't even enter it once. You can never enter the same anything. But your mind can decide it's the same and then immediately pull comparisons and immediately get into like and dislike. And you haven't even entered a different river once at that point. You might as well not be there. So was there more that you wanted to bring up or another question? Or? Mostly to maintain our sense of security by having things go the way we think they should. We get caught by like and dislike, don't we? We have a view of what we're doing today, and somebody cuts in front of us on the highway, and you are intervening in my worldview. So you understand why I was talking about Adrea here. Isn't that basically what she's doing? Someone who doesn't help her become more and more isolated is the head of a conspiracy.
I said, to her on the phone. Well, maybe it's a conspiracy, but not the kind you think it is. It's a conspiracy to open her up, or whatever you want to
care
say.
For her.
Yeah. And if I asked her what kind of conspiracy, she never said.
No, she won't tell me either.
No.
She says, I've got to hang up now. So I don't think that's the name of a conspiracy. Because then she usually hangs up.
Yeah. But that's a control.
It's all control. It's any time we are clinging to the way we think things should go, it's a control. Isn't it? When you really are honest about it, you would like to be the only one in the universe. As long as everybody else is still there but they obey you. That's the only little rider. That's not asking too much, is it? Huh? And okay, I'm willing to let you be here some of the time, but I'm the major player. And when I was sitting this morning, I was like trying to imagine seeing myself as not the person who was sitting there, but having a consciousness that included everything else, that was as aware of me as I was aware of a chair or something. It was really interesting. I wasn't able to do it. But it sure was interesting. Because we are the star of our own life, aren't we? And everybody else's reality is like, but it's not, what's the use, you know? Cynicism, you know, exuberance, desire, you know, stubbornness. We have a thousand ways of upstaging everybody else who might enter the scene, don't we? The people who tell me that they never lie, they're the biggest liars I have ever met. You notice that? It's not that they lie, it's that they tell you what they think is true.
There's a personality test we're just learning about in psychology. And there's one section that they ask these simple questions, like things that everybody has done, like little minor, you know, like,
do you lie?
Yeah, and they said that the people who score well on this are either the ones who are like, you know, priests or something, and they never do anything wrong, or they're the criminals in jail. So it gives a lot, it gives that perspective.
Yeah. Neat, eh?
Yeah.
That's lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, as somebody who at one time was sworn to honesty because it was what we did in my family, you know, poor but honest, I can tell you what a righteous, bitter, nasty thing honesty can be. How it can be worse than a knife in many cases. And you all know that from yourselves, don't you? Every once in a while you're honest about something. But what it is you're being honest to is questionable, isn't it? So there comes a point, and I'm not saying that you tell lies or you get away with it. I'm saying like to understand whether honesty is from your idea of what's real or from your heart. It's a very interesting thing. And if you can't tell the difference between like and dislike, you can't tell the difference between when you're being honest from your sense of how things should be or from your heart. And it's your heart that isn't capable of lying, not your brain. Your brain plays politics, your heart states the feeling. Isn't that true? Your brain says, I'm lonely. Your heart says, they got what I should have got. I'm sorry, your heart says, I'm lonely. Your brain says, they got my share. Right? So that doesn't give you a way to have an honest dialogue with loneliness. How are you ever going to heaven, hell, and earth learn what loneliness is, what its gifts are. If you're always blaming something outside of yourself for it, how are you going to learn that? Or fear. How are you ever going to learn the gifts of your heart if you keep jumping to the head based on like and dislike? How many people won't just test their fear? A lot, eh? Do you think that's true? How many of us stay in what we already know, decide we're going to be good? Not because we actually prefer the good, but because it's our duty. Do you know what I'm saying? Am I making any sense to you?
Yes.
This is still talking about like and dislike.
Yeah.
But whether you're willing to step outside of your safety boundary and always be somewhere for the first time and be interested in how it feels to be here. You know, that's the work of a saint. And I ain't there yet, but when I do manage to, you know, swing through that patch, I'm very glad, very happy. It's very satisfying to be alive, whether it's fear or loneliness, and think, this is it. This is the moment that is. No past, no future. What is present? What is breathing now? You do not have to close your heart from being in love with whoever you are. When I am actually a good friend, which sometimes some people find me, it's when I'm doing that. Do you think the same thing is true of you? So this is tied to like and dislike, isn't it? We have this expectation of how we should be, and then we have this feeling of how we are. And when how we should be clashes with how we are, we dislike how we are. So we distrust the heart. Right? Wrong? We have this expectation of how we should be, and we have the feeling of how we are, right? And when there is a clash between those two, the expectation of what we should be isn't measured up with how we are. We have a clash. And usually it's the heart that loses that one, because the politicking starts. Mm-hmm. Whose fault it is, or, you know? You know, I'm marred goods, they're marred goods. As if there were a normal. Yeah. Show me a normal. Like, I dare you. I dare you. I dare you. I dare any of you show me normal. And if you point at anybody but me, I'll know you're lying. Because I ain't normal. But there is this kind of little quality test we carry around in our brain. Isn't that true? Because we're always looking for something outside of ourselves. And that little quality test is how we judge whether we should be running after yet another one. And when we're tired, we feel, oh, there must be something wrong with me. We don't say, oh, what's tired? Right? When we're sick, we say, oh, I got to go to the doctor. Don't we? Get a headache, take a pill. When do we have a right to be alive? We're always like trying to be normal. So we like or dislike anything that swings outside of our personal, and it's very personal, view of normal. But where's the freedom in that? Freedom means not being subject to, doesn't it? Not being subject to. And the number one thing to not be subject to is the one new being that the Buddha called the builder when he said, I have found you, O builder. You will build no more. The one that's always trying to figure out how to keep yourself up, down, in, out, round, round. Keep yourself. The builder of the self. Without even wondering if there is one. maybe an insight into, gee, who am I? Is the beginning of really being alive. Seems like it could be to me. Not what I haven't achieved or what I haven't done, but what I? What a mystery. Is this all right?
Yeah.
Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints?
I have a comment. I thank you for suggesting that John Spahn book last night.
Spahn?
And it's good. And he's got a great sense of humor.
He does, doesn't he?
So I'll be sitting there laughing and then I'll cry or something. It's a great book.
I'm glad.
Yeah.
Okay, what's the book?
John Spahn.
Oh, you talked. Yeah,
John Shelby Spahn. Yeah, it's called "The Sins of Christianity," isn't it?
Something like that. Yeah,
The Sins of Christianity. It's really worth reading, and he does a brilliant kind of little history. He takes the various things that often are considered to be against the Word of God in our modern form of Christianity, like lesbianism, Judaism, and so forth, you know? And gay, homosexuality, Judaism, and so forth. A whole bunch of them, women having the right to vote. And, well, I know I'm augmenting that a bit, but that sense that women are happier obeying their husbands, and, you know, that kind of thing. That kind of... And he traces the history of it. He actually shows you why, you know, have you ever heard the expression, you're Jewing me?
Yeah.
Where does it come from? Where does it come from?
One time, was it not, handling money was not a clean act to do, and charging interest was not a good thing to be doing, so it was...
Why wasn't it a good thing to be doing? Because it was usury, and it was a sin against Christ. So it wasn't a good thing for Christians to be doing, right? So the Jews who weren't Christians, they could be the bankers. They could be the mortgage brokers. They could handle money. Then it started to get successful. So even though people were saying things like, you're Jewing me, then pretty soon the Gentiles were the Jewings. Fascinating, isn't it? And how many of us remember that? That we actually forbade Jews, the WASPs, my background, forbade Jews from owning property.
How long ago?
What was that? 1400s? That's not that long ago, is it? Really? A few hundred years. And look at that expression, it's still there, but people forget the meanness of the race that made the expression. Whenever we're guilty of something, we cover it up with an insult, don't we? It's your fault.
And if you didn't own property, you weren't allowed to vote.
That's right. You had no voice in the politics. All their farmland, you know, Jews were mostly farmers. All their farmland was evoked. They weren't allowed to hold property, own anything. Isn't that interesting? So the expression, you're Jewing me.
I don't think I've ever heard that. Maybe it's a generational thing.
No, I think it's just not very often that that's even reported anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things about Spahn that's so interesting, is he goes through these histories. And he talks about the bias that nobody ever quite looks at. Because there's still people, you know, in Didsbury, Alberta, like your age, say to somebody on the street, oh, you're Jewing me. Because their mother did, because their mother did, because their mother did, because going back to the 1400s. Interesting, isn't it? And, you know, if you're Jew, you might take offense at that, Or you might think, boy, it's interesting how I can like or dislike something that the other person doesn't even know why they're using. And if you're a Gentile, you can think, yeah, because, you know, Jews are usually in banking and just slough it over and not ever say, gee, I wonder why I'm saying that. Isn't that true? Because it's comfortable. It's what my mother said and what her mother did. And he just highlights a lot of those little issues, doesn't he? Mm-hmm. He just brings them forward so you actually see them in a historical context. It's a really brilliant book, you know. I think it's his best book, actually.
I mean, I responded to that, too, because I didn't read it, but I think some of the things that he talks about in the book have been addressed and are being corrected in some ways, or being looked at.
Some are.
And
by some people.
Well, yeah, but still, I think if I look at some of the stuff and I read other things, it's more forward.
Last book?
Well, I don't know which you're talking about. That. Yeah.
Yes, The Sins of Christianity.
Yeah,
that's what it's called.
Yeah.
And it's his latest book. And I think it's a leap from his last books. Because I've always quite enjoyed him.
Mm.
But I've always thought, yeah, but this one I recommend. You know, I don't recommend most of the books I read.
Mm.
Because I think he's made a leap in just being very clear and very concise. Like, he's still John Sfong. He still has his own, you know, ways, which are not my ways. That doesn't mean I can't appreciate them. It's not right or wrong, is it? Is it?
Well, no, I guess the thing is that he gets stuck on that. I think.
But he's not stuck on
it. Maybe I didn't read it right, but I think there's some good healing that's going on, though. That's what I'm saying.
Sure there is, yeah. And there's just as much divisiveness going on.
Yeah, and maybe I'll take another generation to clear that up.
Maybe it'll take another 50,000.
Could be, yeah.
But if somebody doesn't name it without blame,
mm-hmm.
just says, this is what happened,
mm-hmm.
when are we going to actually turn around and say, oh, that's how that happened? You know, because it will be, well, what my family always does.
Mm-hmm.
And there won't be any learning. In order to learn from dispossessing somebody because they don't have your belief, why that isn't necessarily useful. In order to learn that, you have to look at it and see what harm it caused, what it didn't do. When you can see what it didn't do, you're more likely not to repeat it. And there is an awful lot of people that do not know that history, and look at this class. Two or three people sort of knew it. But not quite, you know? Isn't that true?
Yeah.
So, and we've all heard that expression, whether or not we've used it, you're Jewing me. Whether or not we've used it, we've all heard it, haven't we? I dare you.
I wasn't sure if I'd heard that. I've heard Jews used in
the same
ways related
meaning.
To money, maybe not.
Yeah, but it's the same.
Enough.
It's the same thing. But that was the expression that sort of formalized it. But yeah, Jews and money. And there's all it, you know.
I grew up in a Jewish area in Winnipeg. It was used a lot.
Yeah.
By the non-Jewish people.
Yeah.
In school, I went to Jewish school, but it wasn't said there.
No.
But out.
But to see the background.
It was.
Yeah.
I've used it.
Yeah. So I'm saying, but do you understand the background of it? You can see what that might remind somebody of, how their whole family heritage was ripped off,
mm-hmm.
or how their children starved, you know, and that nobody paid any attention to that. You can see how that, you know, you can see how that might ring that ancestral memory, can you? If you had to watch your children starve because your land was taken away from you because you were a different faith base as somebody else, you might not take it as just an expression. If the person who had cheated you said, you're cheating me, when you tried to be fair with them. You know, there might be some resentment that would also get passed down. And so what I like about Spong in this book is he's bringing his mind back to those things and just introducing them as historical facts and saying, why would we ignore this? Why would we ignore the neuroses of various of the saints of Christianity? Why would we ignore the homophobia of this one? Or, you know, why don't we value the message more than we want to venerate the messenger? And that's reasonable. That, I think, will do more for those people who really are interested in using the past as a footing for greater understanding than saying, well, some of us are getting it, you know? So that's how I would place my response to you. Because these were real people. On both sides, the ones who thought they had to because their religion said that God was charging them to that their religion was better than that person's, and they had to force, maybe they really loved that family. They had to force them off the land, or their family would have been. You know, kind of like McCarthyism, only up a notch. You know, that's a terrible thing to do in any society. And like Spong is saying, if we don't look at it, this is what I heard him say, if we don't look at it and know this history, how will we stop ourselves from repeating it? Because we always tell lies to cover what we don't want to look at. He didn't say that, but I know that about myself. And I figure I'm pretty normal, as I said before. And if I do that, you do that, and you do that, and you do that, and you do that. Because you're all pretty normal, too. Although, mind you, we're all different. Which is what normal is. Different in every case. No fixed identity to normal. Which is normal. Yes.
Surely this example, though, is one that's great value is to look at what happens now. I was just listening to a talk about Trophy. And I had also read a book about this. The people in the Kalahari, the land grab from northward, so and I was fascinated by a man who is working on old language, or the languages of peoples which are disappearing, referring to the killer languages. So that these people, including the Bushman language and the nice tiki languages, are losing. And it's related to social values.
Yeah.
And again, the land grabs.
Yeah.
And here, the Ukrainian children were not allowed.
Yeah, or the natives, or on and on.
So perhaps one of the great values of looking at history is also to look at
be able to open your eyes to what's present. Exactly. And how subtly it can sneak in. And you see how intimately that's connected with like and dislike. We like to be part of society, the power. We like to be safe. And how if that starts squeezing at you, like your children aren't quite safe or something, what hard decisions you would have to make. I mean, may we never have to go there. Number two, may no one ever have to go there. Number three, if anyone does have to go there, may I be open to praying for them, not turning my back. Does that make sense? That even if it's someone who is choosing to go into absolute, total discrimination based on their own sense that that is the right way and imposing their right on the world, may I not make them into an enemy? That's a little bit of a bigger step, isn't it? Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. That is too good. Bush is made up of non-bush elements. How good is that? Yeah, he could use a little more bush, couldn't he? Cranberry. A few kinds there. Yukon cranberries. Yeah, that would be good. For sure. In the crispness of fall. Yeah, with the bear on the other side. Ooh, bear bush. Yes. That would be good. I wondered why the bush was moving. Ah! That happened to me once. I was up in the Yukon quite a few years ago, visiting my brother, and very dear friend of my brother's was going out berry picking. So I'm just going out with my friend, who is like very comfortable in the bush. You know, one of those Norwegians or something. You know, those kind that you know they can live anywhere in the bush. You know, and you go for a walk with this friend, and you come back, and she'd have. As you'd come into the kitchen, she'd be pulling things out of her pocket and, you know, getting the stove lit up. By the time she had her boots and coat off, there'd be this whole soup that she don't even know where the ingredients came from, boiling and smell. One of those Norwegians. You know them Norwegians. They're all like that somehow or other. I don't know how they do it. You know what I'm saying. So we're just picking. And... You know, the dogs are with, because they always have dogs with them, don't they, Norwegians? Pretty well always go for a walk in the bush. There's always a couple of dogs bouncing around. You know how they are. And so, oh, Ruth, you would know. And anyway, we're out there, and it's obviously no problem. The dogs are rushing off and having a good time, and my friend is over there picking berries, and I see a bush over there. It's really great. I go over and I start at the bottom, I'm bending down, and it's like, you know, you have to pick quite a few before you get a big container of them. I'm picking them, and I'm pulling the branches a little bit, and then I notice that the bush is moving even when I'm not pulling the branches. So I figure my friend's over on the other side, so I keep picking, and I'm not singing or anything, I'm just like enjoying the smells and everything. And then I come around the side, and the branches are moving more, and this bear is coming around the other side, and we both see each other at the same time. and we're like as out of far away, not as far away from the bear as Dawn is from me. And the bear stops and looks at me, and I stop and look at the bear. And we both take two steps back, and we both turn around and run. Oh, shoo. I didn't know I was that scary. Where did that come from? God knows. Norwegians. I got a hit from Norway somewhere. I don't know where. Oh, well, it's gone now. So that whole thing about like and dislike goes into so many places, and it's especially tied to when we feel like ourselves. And when we feel like ourselves, is when we're maintaining our habits, isn't it? Have you ever tried to change some habit that isn't particularly important for you to change or unimportant? Like, you know, the way you cut your hair, the way you brush your teeth, something like that. The way you think colors look good on you. And get dedicated, wear a higher heel or a shorter heel. And you want to watch yourself go through dislike about that? Because you've moved out of your safety, meaning unconscious zone, meaning unconscious, meaning you know who you are so you don't have to be aware. Walking without seeing, right? Remember Gurdjieff's advice? What was it?
Never take the same.
Never walk the same way twice. His advice, if you really wanted to wake up in this life, never walk the same way twice. Remember when I used to ask you to put a little pebble in your shoes? Not one that you could feel all the time, but one that rolled around a little bit, sometimes lodged between your toes, you forgot it was there. Then you tilt your feet under a chair, have a cup of coffee, and you get up, and it's rolled. And you take a step, and it's there, that you have to actually be aware in every moment. Not one that actually hurts you, but one that is, oh, just like, oh, something there. That rolls around a little bit. Do you remember when I asked you to do that? How many of you actually did it, I wonder? I did it several times. That's just why I usually try these exercises before I come to you. Try it. What have you got to lose? My comfort. Yeah, but I don't like a pebble in my... Exactly. Oh, I'm too busy. Meaning, I don't like a pebble in my shoe. A thousand reasons. But what about being interested in who you are not? That could be a whole huge part of your being. Not who you are and the habits that you've been working with your lifetime, but who you are not. Isn't that a good idea? Move past your comfort zone. There's lots of ways. I'm sure you're way more inventive than me. I mean, look what a Scorpio thing to do, not a Gemini thing to do. A Scorpio thing to do. You know? Put a pebble in your shoe. I'm sure you could, you know. I'm going to walk around using my middle name, if you always use your first name, as my main name or something, you know, something nice and two-faced, like Gemini, like that. Gives more options. Divine twins. Introduced myself to everybody by Flora. Hello, my name is Flora Quiet. Oh, Flora Quiet, what am I? I'll get the same line, but it will be a different me introducing myself. Never did like the name Flora. Maybe I should do that. Maybe I should officially tell everybody my name is Flora Quiet. Isn't that interesting to like actually start to play with your own sense of self? Because you know how habituated we get, don't you? And at the end of the day, when you come out of work or whatever, there's one mood that starts pretty well every day, right? Come home, stretch, turn on the TV or whatever, right? It's like right there, isn't it? What about if you changed something there? What about if you turned on the radio and decided to do dance around the room three times before you did anything else? Never walk the same way twice. It's your life. Your kitchen. Your radio. My middle name. You can have it if you want. You see, Yes, my name is Flora Haynes. No, it doesn't work, does it?
Might have that same.
No, Fauna Haynes, maybe. Well, no, still not quite. No. Jeff. So I think I've just about done lambasting that one. Anybody else have any questions, answers, comments, or complaints?
I was wondering how one could best prepare oneself to maybe take on pain or suffering of other people without oneself turning negative.
Have you ever experienced pain?
Yes.
Do you now sometimes experience pain?
Yes.
Is it something that comes and goes a bit?
Yes.
Do you usually take medication if it's severe?
Sometimes, not all the time.
So when you have, I get headaches, I get migraines, they can be quite severe. But quite often when I have a migraine, unless it strikes in the middle of the night and wakes me up and I can't go back to sleep and I've got a lot I've got to do, like drive the next day, quite often I just stay with the headache and just try to see whether my body is caught in pain or my dislike of the pain is caught in it. And can I see it just as feeling? So that I'm not focused on that the pain has to be got rid of. Because if I'm focused on fear of the pain and thinking it has to go away, there's no way that's going to work all my life.
But that it's going to come back, it does go away.
Yeah. That's like a temporary measure that's like hoping for more than is possible. But if I can give myself permission to see, is there something about pain? Is there a space in pain where one can be an observer rather than subject to it? Then when you know that, when you're around someone else's pain, you immediately are able to do the same. It's harder watching somebody else in pain than being in pain yourself. Unless you know where the observer's seat is in the theater of pain. And you realize that pain is not the whole focus. But pain does different things. When someone is dying, pain helps people let go. Some people. When I work with people who have had a lot of trauma and they're on retreat, they will go through great periods of pain sometimes. And by teaching them where to observe the pain, suddenly the whole emotion that's caught with that pain releases very, very quickly. 5 minutes can do major change. Suddenly their whole being shifted differently. Suddenly they're no longer caught in that emotional pattern. Suddenly they have all these memories connecting it and they're empty. Suddenly they feel differently in their body. You know that one. When somebody has a release, their whole body moves different. And suddenly that is no longer part of what they're going to recreate in the next moment. It's not going to be their rebirth linking karma. So if somebody is dying, isn't that a nice thing for them to be able to do? Go through pain in a, rather than it reminding them of something that freaks them out. Be the observer, let it come, let it empty, and they are still a purity, not marred, not wrong, not, right? So just as a quick to find the observer in your own pain, have you ever cut yourself, you watch that fear, be the observer of the fear.
that's interesting, because by asking yourself or someone else to observe it, that's different from feeding into it.
Absolutely. You're not negating it, you're not affirming it, you're saying, is there a place to observe it?
Mm-hmm.
You don't negate it, you don't affirm it, you don't have to. Just like anything that comes from your heart feeling. You don't affirm it, you don't negate it, you just notice it. If it's loneliness, if it's a physical pain, if it's fear, you don't negate it, you don't affirm it, you just find the observer's point. Watch it come, watch it go, it's a wind. And you see, like, I mean, that's what, you know, that's what I learned from Zen. 9 months sitting Zen in Kyoto, this little temple. Hmm?
In Kyoto?
Yeah, on the edge of Kyoto, Japan.
Yes.
Just at the north, west corner. Beautiful teacher there. And it was painful, you know, like the five-day sesshin every month. Long hours. They do not so much walking, lots of sitting. It was very interesting. By the fourth day, you were dying. So one session, I actually didn't go back on the fourth day. And then I went to see the teacher, whose name was Uchiyama-san. Beautiful teacher. And I went to see him. And I knock on the rice paper door, you know, take your shoes off on the other side, kneel, knock on the door, wait, kneeling, just like this, you're kneeling on your knees, and he says, come in, and he's doing brush painting, and he was actually an origami, what's it called, origami master. He should have seen the things he did, my goodness. Anyway, blah, blah. I'm obviously getting old. And, Jiwa-san, come in. Because when I was ordained by my teacher, Ananda Bodhi, perhaps you've heard his name, Venerable Ananda Bodhi, ordained me. Have you ever heard of him?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You ever heard of him?
Yes.
How about you, Helper?
Was that the former name of the Rinpoche?
Oh, yeah, Namjo Rinpoche became the next life, next incarnation. But then he was a Venerable Ananda Bodhi, and he ordained me and gave me the name Jiwa Tantra. And then after I did a 3-month retreat, after being ordained, then he suggested I go to the East, so I went to first Japan. And so I was still fairly new as a So I kept my name, Jiva Tantra, and so Uchiyama-san called me Jiva-san. Ah, Jiva-san, come in, please, come in. Jiva-san, you know be at meditation. Oh, Uchiyama-san, oh, my legs, my back, so sore. Ah, so, ah. Uchiyama-san, everyone's legs, back, very sore. So simple. You know, just so simple. You're here to do something and you're making a choice not to do it. You know? So simple. We're here to be alive and we're making a choice not to do it. So simple. Mm-hmm. So then you learn how to sit and watch pain. After you finish disliking it or thinking, I paid fucking money to come here. Or, what was that name of that movie where Robert Redford was, oh yeah, and then there was, know, playing the old movies on the walls, you know, because we faced a wall, all of that. Eventually, you just watched, you know, you'd say, no, oh, feeling. And you would be sitting there with the blank mind, but feeling would be coming up, it would be so strong. So you just try to see, watch the pain. Where is the pain? Is the pain in that leg or is it in that? Observe his chair. Not, I've got to get away from this pain, or I can't stand this pain, or I'm going to take some drugs for this pain. Nothing to do except see the pain and start to explore the feeling of pain. Is it actually from the leg or is it from my brain? Well, I actually don't know. Oh, for goodness sake, look at that. The pain is actually in waves. Is it the waves of pain I dislike more than the feeling? Do you hear me?
There'd be a sense if I was sitting, and this does sometimes happen if it's a good pain or a bad pain. Like I had a ski accident once with my right leg, so sometimes if I'm sitting for, even during a chinrezi, or if I sit for more than about half an hour, 40 minutes often, it'll start to go numb, and I have to move around. And
you don't actually, if it goes numb, you don't actually have to move around.
Yeah.
You don't actually, but you can make your bum just a little bit higher when you sit.
Mm-hmm.
That would help it.
Okay.
Just make your tailbone, just the tailbone, a little higher.
Okay.
That would help it. But you don't. Your legs can go numb and come back from going numb. You don't have to move for that at all. Pain? Sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to decide whether you want to see whether you want to sit through it or not. As unlikely your leg is going to fall off from 1 hour of sitting.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And most of the time our sense of having to do something, having to fix something, not being good enough and all that, is this kind of slight restlessness.
Mm-hmm.
So when you actually start learning how to meditate, or teaching yourself to really bring the mind to that neutral point that I'm talking about, all of the resistance starts, well now wait a minute, you know, we've been involved with entertaining ourselves with everything that could be wrong or right or where it really is or where it isn't. Maybe we just want to, no, maybe you don't want to go, you don't want to go there.
Mm-hmm.
And you just keep trying to sit. Oh, your leg's starting to get numb. Watch out. Oh my God, I bet you won't be able to walk for 15 years after you get up today if you don't move. No! But it's like little messages that come through the body. And like when you actually just decide you want to just sit for, because you know, you watch yourself, you watched other people, sometimes when they're absolutely wrapped in something, totally engrossed in something, they sit for 15 minutes, 20 minutes, an hour, not a problem. Right? So you know that if you can shift your weight a little bit, you don't necessarily have to move. You could shift, okay, is anything actually falling off? No, it's okay. Yeah, I'll get back to you. And look for that observer point. Because that's the difference between being caught by your mind states or making a choice, is whether you can do that neutral point. That's the difference between transmuting crap into compost. That neutral point. When you trust that neutral point more than you trust your ability to distract yourself with despair or joy or toys or, you know, isn't that true? When you can trust that neutral point, you're alive. You allow experiences to come. You allow them to go. You then know what an experience is. So when it arises in yourself or when someone else, it doesn't put you in the position where you can't stand it. And you know? I usually tell people when they're first learning how to meditate, a group of people, they invite me, they say, you know, we want to learn to meditate. I say, yeah, the most important thing to learn to meditate. how to hold a focus. When you can hold a focus, whether you feel like you're going somewhere or you're about to awaken or doing some great meditation or, you know, about to purify the entire universe of all, you know, whatever great grandiose superhuman costume you've got prepared in the closet. First learn just to focus, especially when you're bored. That's heroic, isn't it? Without moving, let the itches come. Let the numbness come. Let the itches go. You know you have not yet died from one of your itches. Be very rational about this. Say, what would happen if I didn't scratch? Well, you know what happens? It gets worse. You say, what would happen if I shift my focus to there being a warm spot on my right buttock? You know what happens? The itch gets less. You play. You know, eventually we all learn that, but maybe if it's spoken, it makes it easier. I mean, I could disappear for hours in the next poem I was going to write and look like I was really meditating well. So it took me a long time to actually pay attention and a certain amount of desperation. So if any of you are into writing poems or whatever, maybe this will be useful to you. Planning your day's events tomorrow or, you know. Where are these thoughts coming from? Do you understand me? You look for that neutral point. You've got the balance. But you have to look for it. You have to decide. And you can't get angry if you don't find it. Or you can't think that somebody else can do it or there's something wrong with you. You can't do that. You have to think, oh, almost got it. Oh, good. Maybe this time. Anytime you judge it or start, you know, disciplining yourself or thinking it should be different, glub, 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 back in the pain. Yes. I'm saying you could do that.
Well, that would be a one.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, if you keep thinking of certain thoughts over and over again. Okay, what is the moment just before that thought comes up? Where is this thought coming from? Is there some particular feeling or taste or color? Why does this thought come up? You know? What precedes this thought? So you're not focused on the thought, you're focused on the state. Already, you found a neutral place to let a thought come that usually just sucks you right in. You know, when I play a lot of solitaire, because I have that tendency when I'm talking, I have a couple of friends who phone me from long ago and far away, and regale me with stories about what we did in high school. And I play solitaire when they're talking to me. And we are taking some things off this tape. And then when I'm going to sleep at night, and I have trouble sleeping some nights, so solitaire games start appearing in my brain. So I get to play with that. I imagine it's suddenly already finished and I won. Suddenly already finished. Oh, that was the last card and I lost. And it gets to be kind of fun. And then just what are the cards made of? But do you understand, you can change the track. You're the recorder. You can rewrite the track that's going on this tape. Anytime you want. I imagine that the cards are falling in no particular order at all, that they just start like that and then they fall like autumn leaves. And I start watching some of them drift down like this rather than just appearing like they do on the computer. Because I will stay awake for a solitaire game, but I won't stay awake for relaxing. You know, I love to maybe one more card. I'm a board game gambler. But, you know, to actually just be present in the moment is that's the point that you fall asleep from, isn't it? That exercise about watching the breath that you fall asleep on. That's what you're doing. You're teaching yourself, can I just be present just for the breath? And the habitual thoughts start that you usually sing as your lullaby for falling asleep. You say, oh, wait a minute, is that on the in-breath or the out-breath? And if you're really lucky and you've got lots of good rebirth linking karma from previous lifetimes, you'll actually be asleep and suddenly think, am I asleep or awake? Because you've actually followed consciousness into the sleep pattern. And if you don't get too excited by the fact you realize you're asleep, you can actually kind of get familiar with that. And you can start watching the internal organs turn to the night cleaning crew that comes in. You know, the liver functions differently, the kidney, all function differently when you're asleep. It's like the office crew comes in and cleans at night. For the next day, you know, all the waste baskets are dumped, and it is a whole shift. You can actually watch your body go into a self you didn't even know you were. That's just an incredible cleaning crew. And there is quite a different kind of feel. It's quite wonderful. And then you find out that you don't know where you were. You're back somewhere, conscious. And you realize, oh, I actually just went into sleep. Oh, and now I'm coming out of deep sleep. It takes practice to get that way, and I've really only been able to do it on retreat, when I'm on retreat, like watching the mind going to sleep. It's not so hard. But you have to be interested in the neutral point to do it. The neutral point is a very powerful place. Get you out of calamity. Because calamity is being traumatized over and over again by the same emotion. Change your focus, the emotion doesn't traumatize you, rewrite the script. The script is already rewritten. However I got into that.
It's okay.
It was the solitaire on the computer. How we doing? I owe you 20 minutes, it's 9 o'clock now, what do you want to do?
You owe us 20 minutes?
Oh.
Yeah, I was 20 minutes late.
I guess following that, I know we asked the question, or I know you answered 10 years ago, whatever, but what's the difference between, I guess I do and I don't, but how would you describe the difference between Zen meditation and Theravada meditation? I know that one is insight and one is more, how would you describe the difference?
You know,
what's better than the other, but.
No, I understand what you're saying.
Okay.
You know, for me, it would be very hard to answer that question because I have had Theravadan teachers who were more like Mahayana teachers in terms of their approach to focus and balancing. And I've had Vajrayana teachers who were more like Theravadan teachers in their sense that, okay, now that you've got the confidence, let's go to insight.
Mm-hmm.
And who don't use the transformation part of Vajrayana that's the same. So in terms of a generalization, I could say generally speaking, as long as you don't hold me to it, okay?
Interesting.
Right. Oh, scribe. Right. Get your pen ready. Does she need more quills? So Zen. Zen, basically, what you're doing, I mean, I sat with two different Zen teachers, one of them, and one of them we faced a wall, and one of them we faced each other in a certain way. I've sat with other Zen groups too, and other Zendos too, but the most extensive I did were these two in Japan. And although they had different systems of going about it, the basic sense was what you need to do is run through all of your possible ways of entertaining yourself until you're fucking bored with it. And little moments of the clarity of the mind that has never been separate from transcendence will arise. And you won't recognize them. And you'll run through a whole other group. But at one point, when you least expect it, if you sit enough, you'll be walking across to go to the bathroom or something. And you will just put your foot down, and suddenly you will see the clarity. And have what they call satori. So it's like, just sit there until you get it. Don't go into any entertainment. And they have symbols and they have ritual that are more like the Vajrayana. Mm-hmm. But they happen on occasion. Mm-hmm. And the main practice for most of it is a certain amount of chanting, but just sit. Just sit and watch the mind. And it's very effective, especially because eventually you'll get bored. You know, your own dramas are only impressive in so long as you can entertain a few other people as well as yourself, so you can add spice to the show, right? Somebody who disappointed you, or somebody who thought you were the hero, you know, right?
Yep.
But if you're just left on your own, there's a kind of a... And then if you're in one of those temples, which I did most of my sitting in, where there's a guy walking around with a stick, and you actually get to that point where you realize how painful it is to be sitting there like this, so that when you see the shadow of him passing on the wall, as he's coming close to you, you bow to the wall and you put your hand here without looking or anything, then he is being told by you, hit me on this shoulder, get the blood working better. And then if you want the other shoulder hit too, you should hit right there. Right on that muscle,
right.
And it brings energy in. The teachers that I have sat with, where the stick is, you ask if you want it. When you know, you can feel or hear or see the shadow, and when you see the person who has the job of the stick walking around, and you want them to give you a little boost because you're drowning in sloth and torpor and repetitive crap, then you bow. And then whichever shoulder you want them to hit, you put your hand on the other shoulder. And then they bow to you, and then they take the shoulder, and it's very much a meditation on their part. They're doing a walking meditation, and they... And then you sit there for a moment. And then if you want the other one, you do that. They bow. They bow. Take off. Nice, eh? You don't have that in Theravada. And I think a lot of people who haven't experienced that don't know how relieving that can be.
Well, not getting smacked?
Yeah, like no getting smacked. Mm-hmm. And they don't understand how wonderful that is to have something sharp cut through the sleepiness, because you know you're going to be sitting there another 5 hours. And you know it will go on and on. And then when it starts coming next time, you remember the feeling of that hit. So it's like mostly teaching the mind to open beyond the movie. Zen. The insight practice, although very rarely in Japan, in Thailand, in Sri Lanka, in Burma more, but very rarely Cambodia, Vietnam, Laos, you know, the countries that I've, very rarely do you just get the insight of not this, not this, not this, not this, the boring in mind. You usually get a combination of refuge, naming the qualities of the Buddha, which can be quite a long meditation and very interesting. Meditation on loving kindness, meditation on impermanence, all of those are part of the practice. And insight that not this, not this with the mind, watching just the breath and watching the breath in the body, seeing the body while you're watching the breath, watching, and then extending that and then seeing, you know, where is the self in this, you know, what is the body, then watching the aggregates in the body and realizing they're not a self, and, you know, that not this, not this. Mindfulness of body, mindfulness of feeling, mindfulness of mental states, mindfulness of mental objects. You examine each one of them according to a formula and you see, no, not this, no, not this, no, not this. This is not a fixed self. This is not a fixed self. So it's a nete, nete, you know, practice of like stripping away what is not self. But it is almost always based on a foundation of knowing what is refuge, what is impermanence, what is cause and effect. You know, those are very those are very important practices to balance. When insight came to North America, at first when it came, it was just pared down to the bare nyate nyate, and a lot of people still stick to that. But you find that that can be a little bit dangerous, because if, you know, especially with us Westerners, with our brilliant intellects, where we like to get right to the point and we can argue everything forever. You know how we do that. Mm-hmm. We can end up in, up our own assholes with no way out. And we freak out because we're trying to get something, but we don't see the mind that is getting. So there's no kindness in it. There's no balance, there's no confidence, there's no stability, right? You're taking away the ground, but you haven't left enough for yourself to stand on, so you crash. And so you find, like, in various kinds of people who have done a lot of insight practice, now they go into psychology, or they make point of practicing loving kindness on the side. That's like sort of de rigueur, but in North America, right? But in the East, there are these balances. There's these long periods of chanting. There's these, you know, different every full moon, whether you're in retreat or not, there are certain things that you do, you know, that give it a little sense of balance, right? So,
well, it's almost that if you look at that, I mean, the practice of loving kindness versus just receiving anything, that's where the balance is to be your conscience plus the intellect. You want to use that.
Well, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah. And that's my question last night. Maybe talking about the will, that you need both, because you just have the one will end it.
Absolutely.
It's like the difference.
Because they are partners. Because they are partners. Because you can't have one without the other. You cannot get rid of meaning, whatever the meaning may be. There is no experience in your being that is not necessary for your intellect to awaken. There is no intellectual question in your mind that cannot be supported by meaning. Like they are two sides of the same of the same coin. It's by the meaning reflecting the transcendent, which is brought into focus by the intellect, that awakening happens. And people make a mistake there. So, yeah, I agree. So does that answer you? Have I cleared up my misconception about from last night?
Yeah, just kind of pure consciousness without the other.
I mean, there is already pure consciousness. But very often it's obscured by our meaning, which thinks it should only be part of it, or, you know. Or our meaning is open to pure consciousness, but the mind is saying, oh yeah, but is it purer this way or purer that way, you know? And that is always when there is some sense of a self that one holds to, that is good, bad, or indifferent, rather than seeing how changeable it is. You know, I wish I had a dime for every time I said to many of my teachers, but I just can't do this, I've never been able to, as if there were such an I. I treat us all to coffee, at least. Because it's so convenient, you know, when you don't get what you want, to just say, well, there's something wrong with me. The sob sister just moves right in, you know, I got the Kleenex, I'm ready. Sorry?
Okay, well, did the Buddha, did he teach Zen meditation, or did he teach Zen? Because some Zen masters will say that our lineage goes back to the Buddha, right?
Yeah, well, because the Buddha is a state of immanence, like that could be true. Don't you think?
Yeah.
I mean, you can say that about every, you know, it was one of the things that really confused me in Japan, because that was my, after meeting with Buddhism, that was my first experience of being in a country where Buddhism was practiced, and there were so many different teachers, each of whom was teaching the right way. And I found that so confusing, because I got something from each one of the ones that I studied. Each one of them opened a door for me that the others didn't. And so I couldn't disagree and I couldn't agree. And then when I would go to one, you know that if you go to one teacher, you meet all their students. And then once you've met their students, because you've gone to that teacher, then they assume they, of course, are also one of those students. And you know, many people who are students do it like they're signing a pledge of allegiance. Don't they?
Yes.
And so this is the right teacher, or this is the wrong teacher. What does that leave if you have a bad day with a teacher and you want to stay away for a while and figure out what you really want? I mean, like, you're in hell? Is that a little bit like, you know, I'm one of the saved and I'm one of the damned, isn't it? So, like, I had a little trouble with that when I was, like, 9 years old. So whenever I would meet that, I would, like, go. And then, like, you'd leave a class by, you know, there was this one incredible teacher. He did the Heart Sutra, like, blues. He was so good. Loved it. Beautiful teacher. Kaborisa. And he had this teacher who was actually quite famous, I hope she's still alive, wrote several books on Zen, and she used to come to my place for tea after a session, and she would say, Zen is the only way. This teacher is the only true Zen teacher. Well, I'm sitting with another teacher too, you see. And I'm changing her accent. It was actually a German accent. I'm pretending it's sort of kind of like quasi-English, the way I'm talking. But she was very authoritative. And then I would go to somebody else who had been, you know, was practicing to be the head of a school, was in their last years of becoming a Roshi. And he would say, this teacher is the only teacher. And then somebody else would say, you know, this is the only way. And it was a different school of Zen, and they did it slightly differently, and they ran up and down mountains. And this is the only teacher. point. But then they're like, there's that social pressure to join the in-group. And I'm thinking, well, maybe they're right. Maybe there is an in-group. And then I go to Thailand, and I meet a few very great teachers. I actually get to study with them. And I meet their groupies. And I meet some other people, foreigners who were in Thailand. Phalangs, foreigners in Thailand, and some of them are very authoritative, very, you know, some of them are quite famous today, and very clear, and they're able to study with this teacher that basically, if you're female, you really can't study with, because it's Thailand. And then there's a couple of other teachers that some of the very authoritative, that you can study with this one, but he's usually really crowded, and, you know, and there's, it's hard to find space. And oh, there's this one too. He's also very, some of his students very famous. Actually, you can do retreats with this one. And then there's this woman here who teaches this one. And each of them has their groupie. And each of them are telling me. And I can see what each of them are getting. Because I'm usually pretty good at seeing people. You know, I can be right off the wall, but I can be right off the chart, wrong in seeing people, but I can also usually have a good sight of it. And I'm thinking, first of all, is it important who is the only real teacher if you benefit from it? Second of all, how do you know if you've benefited? Those are my questions. And why do people talk about it so much? Great question. So I'm studying the sutras, because there's a whole translation of all that's been, Polytech Society, all that's been translated, and nobody's using it. It's all English there. So I'm working through the sutras. And then I come across one of the sutras that describes, so I like would read a sutra and meditate on it for a while, and then I go to the next one and meditate. Did that for quite a few months. And I come to one sutra that says, you know, talks about the 10 fetters that fall. The first 3 fetters that fall with the first experience of path. The next 2 fetters that are weakened. Do they actually fall? I think they're weakened. And that at the second experience of path, third experience of path, they, I can't remember now. I'd have to stop and think about it, and I'm just going blah, blah, blah. So anyway, goes through. And then it is very clear to me, because the last experience of path, where one is a fully awakened being, an arahat, arahant, one of the last feathers to fall is conceit. What is conceit? Conceit is not grasping after a self. No. Conceit is thinking that this experience is valid. The experience that I am having, because it's valid for everyone. It's conceit in the path I have taken. So of course everybody thinks their path is the right path. Because you have to be a bloody arahat before you get a crack in that one. And how will I know until I have an experience that goes beyond that? But I do know I like the results so far, although I hate the work many days. So I guess I better keep trying. And that's how I settle the question. That was a long story. Does that help?
Yes.
We have faith, but if our faith is placed in doing the right thing, we're never going to be really empowered by it. If our faith is in doing as much as we are able with the aspiration that it be the right thing, we can do anything with it. But if we have to be right, we're down the tubes, because doubt is always going to enter. The important thing to have faith in is your right to try. That's what faith should be. Not, well, I tried and it didn't work. No, your right to try. There is nothing else that is worthy of faith. Then you have somewhere in you something that knows the truth, and you have the right to try to find it. How's that? Mind you, it's just my opinion and a few other people's. 22 minutes after.
You still made it. 20.
You all owed me 2 minutes now.
We have one extra.
It's a plus minus factor.
Oh, okay. All right. So, thank you again. It's always such a pleasure to have such good friends. Sometimes I think about this group and I think, you know, I should be doing more to bring different energy in. We should be doing some fun evenings, and, you know, and I don't live up here, so I don't quite get around to organizing them. You know, I almost got a poetry reading and then the poetry reader fell through. I mean, can't trust them.
But now we're in Didsbury, it sounds like you've got something going in Didsbury, which sounds interesting.
Yeah, they would have sat on Thursday. Mm-hmm. We've sat twice. This group, small group of people want to learn how to meditate there.
Well, there's several of them.
There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Mm-hmm. And then Heather and Brenda. Pam is staying with me now.
Five people from Disney?
4. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Wow.
4.
Pretty good for a small family.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Disney's surprising. Disney sneaks up and bites you right in your prejudices just when you least expect it. You know? You go read in the paper this redneck rant. That's like just exactly what you expect from small town Alberta. And then the next paper you read, somebody saying, you know, that was kind of like, I think we should consider this more from the point of view of, like, why should we all be the same? Why should everybody do things the way you think they should? You know? Think about your children. Think about your farm, you know? And those are the voices that went up. It's fascinating. It's a very nice town. It's scary. Scary place. Come visit. You'll see what I mean. It is nice, isn't it? Nice going into coffee shops. Mm-hmm. Coffee's good, too. Notice this beautiful gold light in your hearts. Spreads through your body. Of course, your eyes aren't closed. Because you know my teeth will visit you if they are. Right through the room. Anyone you're thinking about, anybody, whether you want to pray for them or you just like thinking about. Just imagine the gold light around you. Any beings. Spreads out through the entire universe, so wherever there's suffering due to ignorance of body, speech, or mind, it's just temporarily washed. And then whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our group together, we share it with all beings, so there's no suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our group together, we share it with all beings. wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings. So thank you for your great compassion. I'm a little tired, so I want to be at the Chenrezig tomorrow, but so I'm going to try to be.